Welcome back, everyone. You're more fun with Marlus. And I think we have a question that you wanted to start with.
I did. I had a couple questions. I don't want to... I should have been there for that discussion. Last time, you guys talked about a couple things. That you were talking about the demons and the differences in, well, in Anima and Animus, and the differences now versus then as far as women's liberation and the different role of women in society. And one of the things that came up was discussing about Esther Harding's book, The Way of All Women, and the role of power and how women can, in their caring, can be power. It can be a power thing. And one of my questions was, is power always bad, or is unconscious power, obviously unconscious power, is bad? But I find myself struggling with power, because there are times when I feel like I need to take more initiative, use more power, but I'm not good at using power in a productive way.
It's almost a question of semantics. I would distinguish between potency and power. But you could use power in two different ways. And it would be, you might say, power with or power over. No, certainly power is very important. And I think because we live in a time or in a value system that says power is bad, particularly for women, then it has its own separate existence.
But is there any time power over can be good? I mean,
sure.
Sometimes you've got to, say, raising children, you've got to set limits that may be considered power over.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it consciously.
Yeah.
And the other question was how the shadow manifests with typology. We were talking about, you know, with the changes of how women are in society between the 1940s and 50s and now, the anima and animus concepts are a little harder to grasp. But part of what I guess I am trying to figure out is how does typology work in that? I mean, your shadow, everybody's shadow would be somewhat different because their presenting typology is different. And somehow... I don't know how to ask the question, but how shadow and typology manifest together?
Shadow is a little harder. I think you can say with the anima and animus, they are, I hate the word always, but maybe we could say darn near always, your inferior function. The shadow, I'm tempted to say it's more likely to be your own function.
Your main function.
Because shadow is potentially ego. And anima and animus are never ego. We'll talk about that today. But take that with a grain of salt. Because, you know, individual variation probably breaks the rule more often than it follows it. Does that help at all? But the clear one is the, I was, you know, this Myers-Briggs thing, I think, is very questionable.
Right.
And so I always tell people, well, look at your dreams, what type is your anima or animus, and you're the opposite.
I guess I was, because I kind of came to Jungian psychology through reading, my initial thing that I read was Scott Peck, and some of the things that Scott Peck wrote about taking more responsibility for the global situation of what you're dealing with. One of his books, he talked about people who work in the military-industrial complex and whether the idea that I'm not responsible for this because I only do this piece of the job, but they need to take more responsibility for the whole, which was good advice for probably a lot of people, but for me it was really toxic advice because I already too much responsibility for the whole. And I thought, how do these things that we're talking about, how are they individually, because just like back pain, if you, you know, if you're, you need to sit forward and you get a ball that sits you back, it's going to make things worse. And each individual has their own individual need, and if your psychology doesn't, Jungian in the whole takes that into account, but I think as people have splintered off or building up to it, they have taken a piece and made it universal, and for some people it's poison.
Yeah.
I don't know. Those were questions that were coming up as I listened to the class.
Well, I'll tell you a dirty little story. A friend of mine was had in therapy a ex-client of Scott Peck, and he kept dreaming that Scott Peck was Adolf Hitler.
Uh-huh.
I think it's too global. And should. It's a big should.
I was reading something by Marie Bonfant over break, and she said that for your imperative function, or for your main function, look at what you kind of naturally do.
Yeah.
Would you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What's the easiest?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's do a little review. We have gone through the demonic demons, and now we're going through demons of a mediating nature. In other words, we're looking at the anima and animus. So we'll come back actually to some of your questions there, Anne, as we go through this. I thought I'd review the Golden Ass and Amor and Psyche, because in this latter part of this chapter, she's going to refer back to some of the characters in that story, and I didn't remember them without reviewing it, so I thought I would just go through that story very quickly. The story starts off with a man named Socrates who gets killed by being overpowered by witches. So right away we're into the anima, the witch. And I think one of the difficult things of grasping this anima stuff is the man may feel that he's in paradise with a certain mood or a certain woman, but in his dreams it will show up as being with a witch. So that the negative anima often feels good. And I think the same for the animus, where the shadow, you don't like the shadow. But the anima may be killing a guy, and he's just as happy as a clam.
Would that go back to what we just said about Marie Bonfant saying your superior function is what you feel good about doing or what comes naturally to you, but if you do it too much, it may feel good, but it's not.
That's not the same. This is more, that's true, of course, and that's where the ego and shadow are contaminated. But this is about basically eros, sex, and desire.
Like you fall in love with somebody and it's a disastrous relationship every time.
Yeah, and you're just thinking, oh, here's the one, you know.
Yeah, well, you're in love. And
they got a knife in your back all the time, you just don't see it. So that witch can be the destructive aspect of positive feelings. Or it can be just flat-out negativity, which often shows up as just the voice that puts you down. You're not good enough, you're not okay, you're stupid, you're ugly, things like that. So that's what the story is dealing with. And I think with Lucius, who is sort of a stand-in for Apuleius, the author, his thing is that he's feeling good about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but in fact it's very destructive to him. And then he's holding aloof from the meaning of those attractions with rationalism and cynicism, typical of that era. Then Lucius ends up lodging with a witch, Pamphile, I think it's pronounced, which means all-loving in the sense of the great whore. So that's the witch would be the destructive aspect of his whoring on him. And then right away he starts enjoying the sexual favors of one of Pamphile's assistants, Photis, which means light. Lucius also means light, but they're two different kinds of light. Lucius is the light of rationality, which only understands logic. And Photos would be an anticipation of inner guiding understanding. But with the anima, that is first met in eroticism. And then the question is whether you can understand the meaning of what you're going through. Let me just say, I think I said it before, but that these clear distinctions between anima and animus I don't think hold anymore. So I'm going to be saying, oh, the anima is this, the animus is that. But the lines are blurred. So you might better think that with the anima, the accent is on this, and with the animus, the accent is on that. That's a little closer to the truth, I think, because times have changed so much since, particularly in these relationships between the sexes, since Jung wrote. The relationship with Photos is cold and sexual, it's purely lust, until Lucius is turned into an ass. We might say a party animal. That would be somebody who just lives from pure instinct. That is ironic because on the one hand it's a step forward, on the other hand it's a step backwards. It's a step forward because it gets him out of his head, and it's a step backwards because he's lost all human feeling. He's just after physical pleasure. But I think it's a very, very important stage. I certainly went through it. I told you guys the dream I had in divinity school. Climbing up a ladder, up, 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 up. That was all that shit they feed you in theology classes. Up, up, up. And suddenly there were no more rungs, and I started to fall. And somebody caught me. Oh, my God, thank God this person saved my life. Put me down. I turned around to thank them. It was the Della. I said, thank you. The devil said, you're welcome. He went one way, I went the other. I had to fall into that kind of just pure heat, basically hedonism. I think it's the way a man who's identified with his mind realizes there are forces stronger than the intellect. Eventually, you realize there are forces stronger than the intellect, which are not pure hedonism, but that's what breaks the identification with mind and should and ideals that are detached from reality. Now, robbers break in and capture him. So the robbers would be just another aspect of the ass, the brutal, thoughtless, taking side, which he has fallen into to his detriment, but also to his eventual gain. The other figure that's, and now I come to the point which she will be referring to, so this is where I'm going into it, a figure named Charite, Charite, like, so it would mean charity. She is abducted by the robbers as well. And she would be now the first real manifestation of the positive anima. So you can see how the positive comes out of the degradation. And it's at the inspiration of Charity's suffering that the toothless old mother of the robbers tells the story of Amor and Psyche. So we had a witch, and now we have a positive anima. So keep that in mind, because Von Fons will be referring back to it. I'll just read you a couple of sections. 126, the story begins. A king's daughter by the name of Psyche is so beautiful that she excites the envy of the goddess Venus, who sends her son Eros to punish the girl, but Eros falls in love with her. They are married in a strange, otherworldly, enchanted palace, but Psyche is not permitted to see her husband, who visits her only at night. Urged on by her envious sisters and by her own curiosity, she takes a knife and a lamp into her room one night in order to kill the monster she suspects her husband to be. Instead of a monster, however, she gazes upon a most beautiful divine youth. Then he reproaches her for curiosity. He takes off. Eventually, they reconnect after she has searched and searched for him. That really makes up the bulk of the tale. And then she gives birth to a girl, Voluptas. And they are married in a marriage on Olympus. One of the things she mentions there on 127 is, and I think this is so important for Ioniclitic work, while he is miserable, something of a underlying process gets started. And that's really what we count on in our work, that whatever we're facing, if we face it squarely, a healing process gets started. And that's what we try to feel into and support to dissolve the particular form of suffering that we're involved in. So that's just a little detail I would remind you of, which I thought was very important. That's the basis of the story. Another thing she mentions, now going back to the golden ass, that was Amor and Psyche within the golden ass, is that eventually Lucius will enter a procession to the goddess Isis, where he eats a rose. And when he eats a rose, he turns human again. So that would that brings into the story another positive figure, Isis. That's why I'm going back to it. Charity was one, Isis is the other. As she'll say, Isis is the real positive anima, or you, in our language, you'd say that's the archetypal background for the positive feminine experience. And charity would be the personal aspect of that in a man's individual life. So by going through the robbers, through being an ass, he's broken of his intellectualism, and he then moves into accepting love, which would be the rose, and is transformed now both with his instincts and his spirit. The rose would be the spiritual aspect of love, and he's already integrated the physiological aspect of love and the physiological power of love.
Can you apply this as well to a woman who's raising
the... I think so. In the second part of the chapter, we'll be talking about the typical animus configuration, which is he isolates the woman. I don't think that's true anymore. I mean, I don't think, that's certainly true. I don't think that's the only way the animus works, that the animus can lead a woman into the same process. The animus can lead a woman into the same process that an anima does. And the animus, or the anima in a man, can work exactly like the animus does in a woman. I was just talking to an older colleague, give you an example of what would be a classical animus statement coming from a man. I was talking about these translation programs that Google's got and other places got on the web. Types up. He says, well, that will never work. I said, it's already working. No, they will never be able to do that. I said, you can do that online. No. See, like, don't bother me with facts. My opinion says this. Well, that was a man. That's what you'd expect to hear from the animus. So I thought, Jesus, I'm talking to an animus-possessed woman here. The same, I think, would be true for a woman, that the animus could lead her into, and I think does lead her into erotic adventures that are necessary but painful. But on the whole, we hear more about men falling at the height of a career, falling for some bimbo, than we do about women at the height of their career falling for an idiot. You could say, well, but there are more men at the height of career spots. But I still think, I can't think of one female CEO that has taken the tumble by dating some 22-year-old jock. So.
So they do insider trading and such like. Animus possessed.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, and so the idea, typically, but remember I think it's necessary to broaden our understanding, is that what the animus does, it isolates the woman from relationships. So the woman may be a hotshot insider trader, but she's alone, she's lonely, she lives in a world of materiality with nothing that really feeds her heart. Again, I think things have changed.
I think she's someone else with who are attracted to boy toys.
The actress that just
Demi Moore.
That's an example of what a man would have done 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for everything I say, you certainly can think of an exception, and that is important. Though I still think I'd maintain that on the average, men tend to go one way, women tend to go another way. But realizing how much that's changed. I think really because of liberation movement, that there are options open to women that weren't open 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Yeah. So what she wants us to see here is how the anima pulls a man into, I use the word adventure in quotes, with a painful, sometimes enjoyable, intense, but ultimately healing process. I guess, you know, come to think of it, Christiana Moore would be, Christiana Morgan, would be a classic example of a woman whose animus behaved, put her into a process like we're typically describing of men. So take all these norms with a grain of salt.
It's going to depend on what that person needs.
What they need, and I never think like this. We teach this stuff, and then I forget about it. Because what we try to do is just understand a person's experience and then look for that, as von Franz said, that subtle development that's getting started within the particular setup of unhappiness. In retrospect, I think you can go back to theory, but boy, I think it's deadly to apply it to anybody.
I think someone who's really caught up with will, you know, just kind of willpower, would act that way.
I think somebody who's caught up with willpower would be more likely to get sucked into an erotic drama. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's passive would more likely get sucked into being transfixed by an ideal. But you're going to get it one way or the other, so don't try to fight it. What I wanted to do was give you a reminder of the role of Isis and the role of charity in the story, because we'll come back to that. And as she says on 1, yeah, I guess that's the main point. I thought to remind us, I love so much what she did about beauty. 128 to 129. How, at least, now we're back to the anima. How the anima sucks a guy in through beauty. And that can be either the physical beauty of a woman or the refined aestheticism of literature or art or anything like that. And she cites the Greek, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, kalon, kagathon, which means that the good is the beautiful.
How does that relate to the one that worked with overweight and
Marion?
Yeah. How does that relate to her work? Because I think that that's one of the things that goes along with body image in women who, you know, women typically are not as focused on what is beautiful in the sense that men are as far as being sexually aroused or whatever, but I think that that has to do with the body image issues that women have, that they do think that if you're not attractive.
Yeah.
See themselves as not attractive. They can't see any goodness in themselves. Right. Well,
I think in that case, they're identified with the man's anima projection. But I would add a little twist here, being a man and all. I've always been fascinated by Arthur Miller, who, you know, had this relationship marriage with Marilyn Monroe. Now, that guy was intelligent. He had balls. You know, he stood up to Congress. He was, Good Night, Good Luck. Who was that guy? Edward Murrow were both charged with contempt of Congress in not testifying against their fellow artists during the McCarthy era. How did he end up with somebody like Marilyn Monroe? And it occurred to me that I wonder if some artists must do that to have the experience of physical beauty, which they then put into their work. I feel what he wrote was not aesthetically beautiful, but was politically beautiful, existentially beautiful. And so I would just add that, I think, that it's not just a negative thing to get sucked into beauty. That they have to have an experience of the beautiful, because their job is going to be to communicate something beautiful to the world, and that's the only way they can kind of get clear what beauty is to have one of these disastrous relationships. So I don't know that that adds to your question or not, but I think it's terribly, this question of beauty is terribly complicated, and I wouldn't always just say, oh, it's just cosmetic.
And the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Oftentimes, I was thinking about it as, and this is very judgmental on my part, man versus woman, but Arthur Miller picking a beautiful woman like her, but a woman, I have seen it more than once, will often pick a man who is not particularly handsome.
Right.
And I mean, it is in the eye of the beholder. I think women are. Okay, my personal observation. Women see a man's potential.
Yeah.
His beauty inside.
Well, yes, I agree totally. I'm just saying this is what a man, this is what the anima does to a guy.
Okay.
And there's no point in fighting. I think a woman's sense of beauty is far more differentiated. And part of finding the positive anima in a man is approaching just that ability to assess that there's a beauty in integrity, there's a beauty in realizing one's potential, there's a beauty in honesty. Well, the anima don't care about that. Beauty's got one one standard.
The thought popped into my head, but there's also, you know, we were talking originally about the demons, and the demons part of this is the destructive, but there can be beauty in that as well. If it needs, it's bringing down something that needs to come down, and yet the initial presentation of that is not beautiful at all.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think we're well advised to use the word daimon. And so, you know, the chapter is the great mediating daimons. it's morally neutral. But if we know how to handle it, it's also the mouthpiece of our individuation. I think it's so important. That sex and the body, desire, Freud would say needs to be recovered. Jung would say absolutely, because it conveys another truth. And we'll get to that next truth in the next chapter. So that in Jung's language, they are the bridge to the self.
Couldn't we reanalyze the story of Amor and Psyche, and that Psyche, as an anima figure for Eros, that she's there to transform him as well?
Keep going.
Well, because he's attracted to her beauty.
Yeah.
And he goes against his mother in order to be with her.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets wounded by her and retreats to the mother. Mm-hmm. So I think we could look at it from both sides.
Yeah.
That it's transforming psyche as well, but it's reciprocal.
Yeah, I'm trying to think whether that fits better to a man or a woman or both. I mean, it might fit to both.
Mm-hmm.
I shall say a little later, Eros's problem is that he's flighty.
And I wondered if he was like a puer kind of.
Yeah, he's a puer.
To mom,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah. And we've never done Faust, but there's a very similar figure in Faust. And in the second part, and he eventually just blows up, and there's nothing left. And I think that's, again, I would go both ways. She makes it kind of one way, I think, a little bit. But on the negative side, it would be where inspiration and faithfulness are not reliable. They come and go. Which would be a sign of immaturity, you know. And what he has to do is become tempered. But on the other hand, I think I'd say he's always going to be that way. And the question is whether the man or whoever is living that can sustain contact with reality when he's flown off. In other words, he's also an image of inspiration. And as you know, inspiration comes and goes. I think part of the art of working with this material is learning what you cannot control and saying, well, here he is. And then tomorrow, nope, he's not here. Think I'll go to the mall.
But he does come back to help him.
Yeah. Yeah, I wondered maybe she's a little too hard on him, but who knows? I think it's the nature of him to come and go. You might say the question is whether we are identified with him or not identified with him. And nobody feels the same way about love and their partner every day. You know, these things come and go. It's the puer who then will leave the partner in a tough time. Or the mature individual will say, well, it's a bad day. Okay, so that was aestheticism. So we go to 129. I have to warn you, I kind of mark what I want to talk about, and I realize, geez, I want to know every damn sentence in this chapter. So we may have to hunker down here a little bit. She then picks up the idea that the bottom paragraph, 129, that they marry in the beyond. This would be kind of what you were saying, Kathy, that it has not entered into consciousness. And that would represent, you know, this situation where we say one thing, we do another. One hears people have these fantastic insights and then go off and do just the opposite. So that, in psychological jargon, the insight has not been attached to the ego.
Before you get to the post, I have to have you comment on
that. Okay. Uh-oh.
I have some thoughts on it myself.
Oh, well, good.
In the middle of the fifth chapter, the paragraph, that is why today the rather clumsy folk art of the early Christians, which I have no idea what she's talking about, moves us more than the affected, moribund ancient art of the Pompeian walking.
Yeah. I don't think she's referring to the Villa Mysteries. But I don't know. I don't know enough about Roman art to give you a description of what she is referring to.
Pomponce has a real penchant for naive art in all her writings.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think
that's just her aesthetic. Okay.
Or lack of aesthetic, because.
Well, I don't know. I think it's a valid aesthetic.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Funny, I was just thinking about that when I was preparing it. I think Jung did too, had appreciation for art that wasn't, the art that did not sacrifice content to form. I think that's what she's driving at.
Well, I think in naive art too often lets the underlying symbolism remain undisguised and shine forth in a way that something that has more technique tends to conceal.
I think that's what they're protesting against.
And that's valuable for the psychologist.
Yeah. Well, Jung has not ingratiated himself to a lot of artists on this very point. He did not like, I don't think he liked any modern art.
No, he liked
Clay. Did he?
But he was what Swiss. Okay. Yeah, he always had a figurative element. That's probably, it wasn't total abstraction.
Yeah, right.
And, things were tied in symbolically. So there was a lot of meat for him to get a hold of in that kind of modern.
Clifford still tried.
But yeah, I think there are a lot of things to appreciate. Like in Picasso, how Jung came down.
Yeah.
But you would have to have a lot of art history under your belt and, living in the modern era to have a feeling connection to it, I think.
Yeah.
So I don't see how Jung could really connect with it until you experience modernity for a certain length of time or you have access to that history.
Yeah, I think Jung's feeling was, my professional deformation is that I am interested in the self's attempt to reconstruct our time. And if something didn't show that, he wasn't interested.
Mm-hmm.
And people would say, well, but, much of modern art shows that the chaos of our times. And Jung says, well, tell me something I don't know. I don't know where to stand on that. I can see his point. It does limit his appreciation of what's going on.
But could we go back to the point of what is nurturing for one might be poison to another, where he was at psychologically was completely different from where the average person might be.
Yeah.
So that might be a true something that is inspiring or does give them vision for the future, whereas he's already past that.
Scene. Yeah.
That's why it's not as
good. Yeah, okay. And that just gives validity to his comment so what? I know this.
Right. Mm-hmm. He knows it, but most people don't.
Exactly. Right.
It is very new and inspired to them.
Yeah. And that's why people are drawn to it.
Yeah. And I think that, you're drawn to what you're drawn to.
Yeah, like Paul Tillich, that Protestant theologian, we studied him in divinity school, and he said that he felt modern theology's job was to answer Picasso's painting of Guernica. Because I think most people are not aware of the horrific destructiveness of our lifestyle. Jung was aware of the destructiveness of our lifestyle. But what's so interesting about Guernica, which I wonder what Jung would say about it, if you look right in the center of the painting, there's a mandala.
Really?
That, it's about that big. It's a flower. Mm-hmm. So, take your pick.
Classic example I think of in this group is the fact that nobody likes football, but football is so huge to the populace of Indiana, and I think it's a symbol. It's a symbol of the, I think it's a, like the Grail image to me. You know, trying to get to the Super Bowl is the quest for the Holy Grail, and people around here are like, oh, why do we spend all this money on football? It's important to people who they're not searching for anything. That's why they're so
attracted. Yeah. Yeah, it does have a spiritual significance, that's for sure.
Well, the whole, you know, feeling of communitas of kind of bonding with others.
Yeah.
I mean, people, that's something you need, you know, I have to get it somewhere.
Yeah.
It's kind of ready made there.
Exactly. Okay. So, she's just talking about the ending. Psyche gives birth to Voluptas, a girl. And then over 130, she compares the birth of the girl to the normal pattern that a divine son is born. And what she says is worth listening to. Third line, Psyche is indeed rejuvenated in Voluptas, but as the name informs us, the process gets stuck in the realm of the animal, which is to say, in the entanglements of desirousness. So, we've already said this, but let me repeat it, that the great problem here is this thing has to start in desirousness. But it can't stay stuck in desirousness. And I think most respectable suburbanites are suffering from the fact that they can't allow themselves the entanglement in Eros. Now, if you went down to the hood, in Indianapolis, you probably find people who are more stuck in the entanglements. So it's important to realize that both poles are extremely important. In other words, that the the real guide to genuine living comes from lessons learned through passion, lust, and love. And no passion, lust, and love, no insight. It's easily possible to have passion, lust, and love, and no insight. So we're always working with both poles. We'll be looking at Osiris along the way here. What happens in the story is Lucius, as an ass, eats the rose, becomes human, adores Isis, and then is initiated into the cult of Osiris. Osiris is the male divinity in Egypt. But because the marriage takes place at Olympus, and because the child born is Voluptas, his problems aren't over. Charity is essentially raped, and she commits suicide because she'd rather be with her husband. Again, we've got the idea of a union, but in the other world, death marriage. Lucius again falls into more robbers. He falls into the hand of a sadistic, evil man, and the suffering begins all over again. I think an important phrase here which was what I was trying to drive out earlier, how when we're dealing with these messes, what we're looking for is the response in the unconscious, which is a positive thread out of the misery and into our genuine selfhood. And so she says, the positive constellations in the unconscious do not reach the surface of consciousness. Sinus, 130, one, bottom paragraph, go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines. Cynicism, egotism, concupiscence is a just unbridled desire, are still uppermost in Lucius. But these features of the conscious attitude do again save him from death at the last minute. I'm not sure what she means there. I think she must mean that because he has another fall, his longing for redemption is all the stronger. His soul, though, suffers deeply without his realizing this consciously. So what we're coming up to now is the resolution. Humiliated and exhausted, he sinks down into onto a beach and has a vision of the rising moon. And he says, it is at this sacred hour that the moon goddess, sole sovereign of mankind, is possessed of her greatest power and majesty. See, so he's gone from the woman as sex object to queen of majesty. And he realizes he probably has suffered enough to experience the other side of the feminine. And then I think the real important stuff is the last couple lines of that quote. Go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines. I beseech you by whatever name, in whatever aspect, with whatever ceremonies you deem to be invoked, have mercy on me in my extreme distress, restore my shattered fortune, and return me to my family, give me back to myself. And he 131, he eats the rose and promises to serve the goddess eternally. That's the goal of this whole process. But he couldn't have gotten to the spiritual aspect of the goddess if he hadn't started off with her physical aspect. And then when he greets Isis, and he's initiated into the cult of Osiris, Eros and Psyche return to him in a higher form, in a form which is attached to the ego. He has changed. And he no longer uses his mind in an intellectual game. Think of academia. But uses it to understand what his role in life is. Where's that?
The goddess Psyche of Isis is no longer the bearer and the bringer of
something
that has become a bridge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which will be what we do in the next chapter. You know, why this is in the a book on projection? Because all this happens in projection. You meet these people, and they feel real as can be, and then you realize after you've gone through it that they may indeed be real, and you may have a real relationship, but also you have been pulled into the relationship through your own expectations, and that is what you can withdraw. And then the self. Who we are, what our work is, what our role in the community is, that's what's given to us. And I particularly like the last paragraph from 132. That it was all well and good, but Christianity came along and squashed it, which we are now back to trying to recover. And I know, you know, Sandy's interest in these pictures. That's what these pictures are about. So the Dionysian ritual, which was squashed by Christianity, was about trying to keep that alive, where the spirit comes through the body. Spirit comes through emotion. Spirit comes through sexuality and eros. And that was the case until basically the Grail legend, until about the 12th century. And what the Grail legend did was picked up that issue. And maybe read the first couple of sentences on 133. Psyche, with the butterfly wings, once again draws near to man and can finally be understood as the principle of a love that has no trace of egotistic motives, and whose goal signifies the individuation of the man. So another way to put this is, it's working through egotism to being able to give yourself to, I'd say, to the reason you're alive. So you see how it starts out with sex, but it ends up with really God, I think. And then she refers to Neumann's work, Amor and Psyche, I have it over there, where he does the same story from the point of view of the woman.
You know, you mentioned spirit coming through the body.
Yeah.
I heard something about the body and emotion that neuroscience is talking about. Maybe you can tell us more about this, Mary Kay, but they said that emotions are rooted in the body, in the amygdala, that part of the brain. And it's a perception via the body. So they say, like, if you see a dead body, your body knows this before your consciousness does. And you react with tears and fright even before you know consciously that there's a body there. And here's the part that I found fascinating. People that are paralyzed find that their emotions are less and that they no longer have the same feelings or emotions. So that part of their identity actually lies within the physical body.
Yeah.
So that if you're paralyzed, you don't feel yourself anymore. Part of your identity is
Has been taken.
So doesn't that really speak to the idea of spirit, you know, this essence in the body itself?
You don't have to be like heart transplants, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
I always wondered about that. I mean, the medicine doesn't discuss it. I mean,
Haven't you heard those stories about people that have organ transplants having these experiences that they don't recognize?
Yes.
And they go back to the family and they find out it's that person's experience. That's just, wow.
But I hadn't heard that about someone who's paralyzed.
Really?
Yeah.
It was on NPR.
Yeah.
It was a neuroscientist. I'm listening to that book on tape right now.
What book?
Mind Sight. It's part of it. From that?
Five Flight.
That's right. Yeah.
Who wrote the book?
His name. I don't know. I'll talk about it on tape break. It's really, he's a neuroscientist. And so mind something.
And in there they draw on that, because I heard that same piece, it's on the William James quote, you know, I don't run because I'm afraid because I'm running. It's kind of that same, that same idea that that you need your mind to recognize what's going on in your body, what can be caused by an emotion. Yeah.
But the, yeah, but the body often reacts first.
Exactly. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
The example of his son were on his trail, and all of a sudden he just panics and he says, stop. Well, his body felt that there was this poisonous snake in the road. He didn't see it. He didn't understand why his body was freezing, but he stopped and then really saw the snake.
Yeah, I think that's one of Jung's enduring contributions, that the self is in the body. Mm-hmm. So it bridges for me matter and spirit. And I really can't stomach anything else anymore.
And this is
what
Marian's work is
so important, yeah.
Way, I guess I've come to interpret a manual, the word a manual, God in us. Yeah. God is.
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's a little bit more and we'll take a stretch. And then she talks about kind of what you were getting at, Kathy, the immaturity. And again, I think I could go both ways. On the one hand, you could see the flightiness of Eros as immaturity, which would mean somebody who can't stick out the battles of a relationship. But I would say that's when the Eros, flighty Eros, is identified with. I think he's always flighty. It just depends on the person who has him. But anyway, I don't know if we want to read that last bit or not, but I call to thee the source of everything living whose wings are outspread over the whole world, etc. The utter importance of Eros. And you know, those of you who heard Darrell when he was here, talk, follow your nonsense. That's how I would interpret his talk, that if you feel Eros for somebody, for God's sake, go find a relationship with him. You know, you may or may not want to sleep with him, but that's your guide. And to do otherwise is to kill the spirit, because that's the way the spirit is communicating itself. And the psychologist would say, oh, but they're a borderline personality. You don't get on with them. Or, oh, blah, blah, blah. Well, too bad. Deal with it. And so what we're getting to then, and we're moving, well, we'll stop here and we'll pick up with the animus, but the bridge she's forming here is the next chapter, that this Eros is the bridge to the spirit that knows the way. Third line down from the paragraph after the quote on 134.
So going back to Marian Woodman's yes, if the animus is always in a person, and it's projected in the person, where does that lead, like, to food addiction? Because is that a block to that animus?
Oh, it doesn't have to be projected onto a person.
Or is that the animus projected onto food?
Absolutely.
And you become so enamored with food that you must believe.
Yep, absolutely.
So that it's usually a passion, but it's not necessarily a sexual passion.
It doesn't have to be.
Passion of that kind of intensity.
Right.
So it can be that or an addiction, which is ends up, it's the bridge, but it's always a negative bridge and difficult to come out of the desirousness.
Yeah.
comic that really could have very been stuff. She's talking about going to the refrigerator and there's a muffin in there. And she, so she starts eating the muffin and gets distracted. She says it's hard to focus on something when you're up your ass in the muffin.
Well, that's the anima. Do you have a stretch? Then we'll tackle the animus.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?
Yeah.